handshake through the drift with us this week as we look at the most major kaiju IP addition to the genre since Gamera, as auteur director Guillermo del Toro takes on several genres at once in a spellbinding, giant robot-sized battle film. We are more than one decade out from this film, so come with us as we revisit and reevaluate this critical part of his filmmaking journey, looking to discover if this is the source of the kaiju boom of the last 10 years or not. This is Kaiju vs. History, Pacific Rim.
Welcome to Kaiju versus History. This is your dumb mech jockey that only uses half of his brain to fight, Patrick. Join me is a one-eyed, gold-booted, switchblade-wielding, black market kaiju arms dealer, Miles. Hey, Miles.
What's up, buddy?
We got a lot of Hannibal Chow in this film.
We don't get enough Hannibal Chow in this film.
He's the mid-credits sequence. He's all over this movie.
I know he's the mid-credits sequence, but like, I still would have had more Hannibal Chow.
Bring back Hannibal Chow. Yeah. 2013's Pacific Rim by Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah, I mean, so going into this movie, I mean, I saw this in theaters. So I'm assuming you did as well.
I honestly don't remember. It was at a time when the wife would not have been interested in this, even though we were big fans of del Toro. Obviously, Pan's Labyrinth, The Hellboy 1 and 2. I've been a fan of Guillermo del Toro since I think I saw Espinazo El Diablo in college. I think that was the first film. Although I'd probably seen Blade 2 before then. I guess I just didn't really realize it was a del Toro film, you know?
Right. I mean, because also Mimic was a big deal in the 90s.
Oh, I definitely saw Mimic.
The English title of the film you were talking about, The Devil's Backbone, is still to this day, like, one of my favorite del Toro films. Like,
it's great. It's a great ghost story. It's
a masterpiece. It really is.
It is. But yeah, it's the first one that I feel like had the director's real touch to it. And then, like I said, I was a huge fan of his Hellboy films after that. And I was hyped. I mean, I definitely saw this when it came out on DVD, if I didn't see it in theater. But yeah, this one. And, you know, spoiler warning, I didn't see Legendary's Godzilla in theaters either.
Wow. That was a nice showing of that movie.
Well, hilariously enough, my wife actually saw that without me. She took a bunch of she's a high school teacher at the time. She took a whole bunch of high school students to see it. And when I was like, oh, do you want to go with me? She's like, oh, no.
No, I'm having a Dangerous Minds moment with my kids.
I was like, can I go when you go see it with the high schoolers? No, that's not allowed.
That's so funny.
Yeah, I missed out a lot. I missed out on Wrath, Clash of the Titans, a lot of big kaiju movies. And for whatever reason, I don't know. I think actually I was like just becoming unemployed in 2013.
Did you not record the episode of The More You Nerd with us about it?
About Pacific Rim?
Yeah.
If I did, then I probably saw it in theater, but I honestly don't remember.
Maybe it was just a part of the talk nerdy. I know Drew and I talked about it a good deal. Mm-hmm. Maybe we didn't actually cover that entire movie. Because this would have been like when we were both on the show. I mean, you were on the show until 2019.
Decade ago, yeah. But yeah, I definitely saw this at the very least when it came out, you know, on streaming or DVD or whatever it was, as soon as I could, because I was a huge fan. Was not at all disappointed.
No, I had super high expectations going in because, you know, obviously I'm a kaiju fan and I love my giant robots too. I mean, massive Power Rangers guy. Mech stuff has been something I think I came to more as a focus later in life, especially meeting Drew and having him introduce me like really into the Gundam universe, even though I remember seeing Wing in the Toonami days. Mm-hmm. So I'm definitely a mech guy now, but I remember just being like on like pins and needles to see this movie, because this was a director I already respected greatly, and combining like two awesome things in a major American motion picture just sounded insane. Because you got to understand, at this time, you know, there aren't a lot of like real kaiju movies happening. Mm-hmm. And because if you look at even the things we've been covering recently, you know, Big Ass Spider, Behemoth, Death Kappa, Clash of the Titans, like, you know, things that are like, you know, have some things that we can kind of fudge and say, oh yeah, there's kaiju in here, I guess. I mean, we do have things like Troll Hunter, which is like, you know, from another culture, which is really cool. But this is the first thing I think we've had in a while, like, that is, you know, full on real original kaiju film that isn't some weird comedy like Death Kappa was, and isn't doing something just completely asinine like Monster X Strikes Back. It's not doing these, you know, cool but like odd fantastical spinoff things like Demi King or Jelly Eyes. Like, this is full on. No, these are kaiju. They're called kaiju, even though in the world of this film, they call the giant monsters kaiju. The opening scrawl says kaiju, giant monster. That is not accurate.
I mean, it is accurate for how the English language uses the word kaiju. But of course, we have talked in, I think, our first episode, the difference between kaiju and daikaiju in Japanese culture. Because if you see a Japanese film with kaiju in the title, it will usually, you know, what we consider kaiju, say daikaiju, which is correct. Great monster, giant monster. We should probably just go over that beginning of every episode. It's like, why aren't you called daikaiju versus history?
Right.
Because people don't understand what daikaiju means.
Yes.
But this opens up with a definition, but also gives us a new one for Jaeger, which is an awesome title, but is German for hunter.
I took away from that back in 2013 was like, oh, so Jägermeister meat.
Master Hunter.
Yeah, I, like, all that clicked. And I was like, I didn't take German. So I you know, was like, no, just never thought twice about it.
Why there's deer on the bottle. Is that got a deer on the bottle?
Yeah, it's a buck of some sort. I love that it does give you this, because like, okay, here are the parameters. And then we have, I'm often little wishy-washy on whether or not we need narrators, you know, like the proper version of Blade Runner doesn't use the narrator. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think for this particular film, the narrator is necessary, because it allows you to just put a lot of exposition in a couple lines, as opposed to having to show everything. And they show you some of it too, but like, it kind of almost gives you like a newsreel of like, you know, here's catching you up on what the state of the world as this movie knows it is. And I really like it.
Is Charlie Hunnam the narrator in the beginning of this?
I believe so.
So his voice, he doesn't introduce himself quite yet, but he's talking for humanity as in response to the kaiju attack. Yeah. Are we ready to get into Pacific Rim?
Yeah. It's funny. I know Charlie has like a very long career as a, you know, a main guy actor, but to me, he is always going to be Lloyd from Undeclared, the kind of waify womanizing English man, college student. He's also in Queer as Folk, the original
British
English version. Yeah.
Yes.
But exceptionally well cast here. We are introduced to him and his brother, who are kind of celebrity kaiju hunters. They are brothers, so their sync rate is kind of unparalleled. And
gotta talk about the title first. How dare you?
Oh, right.
Trying to cue you up.
Sorry. I got super excited about talking about this movie. Patrick, what's the title? Let's go.
Yeah. It takes place in the Pacific Ocean, Pacific Rim. The end. I'm just kidding you. I first want to talk about the release of this movie, which indeed is probably the largest scale release of any kaiju movie since Roland Emmerich's Godzilla, released in almost every single film market in 2013, which is a major coup. because most of them happened all at the same time, which is also rare because for so many decades, it just took a lot of films, sometimes years to get to every part of the world. But yeah, in July of 2013, it went everywhere. Film's tagline was pretty uninspired. Go big or go extinct. Feels like
yeah,
90s, 80s action movie schlock title. But I don't know about you. I don't like the title of this movie, Miles. Pacific Rim. It's just so, it's so banal compared to, let's go through what it was called in some other countries. Some of the other translations for the title, including maybe first off in Spanish, it had a few titles. I believe it was in Mexico, just Pacific Rim, but in Argentina, it was Titans del Pacifico, Titans of the Pacific, which is also a really cool name. Brazil, Circle of Fire, and Bulgaria, The Ring of Fire. So some pretty cool names. I think The Ring of Fire is great, you know, because that's what they call the Pacific Rim, the Ring of Fire or Rim of Fire. Battle for Pacific in some places, Attack on Earth in others. In India, it had a subtitle. It was Pacific Rim, a Battle of Steel, which is pretty metal, pun intended. And Uzbekistan called it Pacific Horrors. The Vietnamese title, Super War. Lots of very interesting translations into other languages. But yeah, Pacific Rim is just, it's a little too simple, I think, for such a huge film.
I don't hate Pacific Rim as a title. I certainly hated the Go Big or Go Extinct tagline. I thought that was just really crappy summer blockbuster nonsense. Pacific Rim, is it my favorite title? No, but I do like having some sort of destination title or something, like a Cloverfield, as opposed to, like, you know, calling it anything else that's going to overcomplicate things. I don't mind a general title for this specifically. And I mean, because a lot of it takes place in the Pacific Rim area, I'm okay with it. I don't know where to start, 'cause there's a lot to talk about this one. There's a lot of background on this movie. I know you said you saw so many notes on, you know, the production history, because there was,
I had to stop after about 4 hours of researching this film. I was like, we're not going to have a 4 hour episode.
So. Well, and again, I say this all the time. We are not an academic podcast, even though we are watching everything and we're called Kaiju versus History. It's not something I really took too much stock into before we came up with this title, but like,
well, we are looking at the historical context of
we where absolutely these movies are. I just meant that we're not doing this big academic deep dive of like giving everyone every piece of information about this movie.
No, but there's a lot of interesting information that I found out even after having seen it several times, having seen the sequel. I really did think that this was always Guillermo del Toro's film from top to bottom. I thought this was his, you know, King Kong of Peter Jackson. I thought this was like a story he was trying to tell. And while it is true, he is a huge kaiju fan, he's also a huge giant robot Evangelion fan. The screenplay, the initial treatment was written by Travis Beecham, who you at the time when this movie, before this movie came in production, was selling his script Killers of Carnival Row and was trying to get that made at New Line Cinema, which fell through and would eventually, like a decade later, be sold as Carnival Row, the TV show. I think it was supposed to be a movie first, but.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was the one with the fairies and Orlando Bloom and stuff.
Correct. And was actually quite good. But
I watch it. I still haven't seen it.
I think you'll like it. So that was his story. And I think while that was not going anywhere, he decided to write another script. And, you know, at the time he helped write the scripts for Clash of the Titans and some other pretty big Hollywood movies. But Del Toro was not attached to direct this originally, but he was going so far back as 2005, he's hot off of Hellboy. This is before he's done Pan's Labyrinth. He was trying to do a At the Mountains of Madness adaptation. An H.P. Love at Universal Studios with James Cameron producing. And supposedly at one point had Tom Cruise attached to play.
Oh, not supposedly. He was officially attached. He had signed on.
So at the same time, I think, Pacific Rim, not by Universal. This is a legendary films with Warner Brothers distributing, came to Del Toro and was like, can you sign on for this film, knowing that he would not be able to do it if At the Mountains of Madness went through? So he signed up saying, yes, I will do, at the time it was called like Silent Seas or whatever the pre-script story, or maybe it was called Pacific Rim at this point, but he signed on to direct Beecham's 25-page kind of like spec script of a giant mech battling kaiju. You know, with 25 pages, that's just basically the outline, but what I really thought was Del Toro's idea of the dual pilots in the drift, like handshaking their minds together. It feels like a very Del Toro addition to this universe, but that was in the original spec script. That was part of Beecham's original story. And specifically, I think Charlie Hunnam's character's loss of his brother and like how they were so connected as the pilots for these mechs. So yeah, after At the Mountains of Madness fell through, I think they wanted to make it a PG-13 movie, and there's also like budget.
Yeah, there's a lot written and recorded about the failed attempt of making At the Mountains of Madness, something that in this era of his career, he has before had said, I'm no longer going to be pursuing this, and has now like kind of brought back the possibility now that like he's won an Oscar and people are like giving him pretty much the world. He's finishing up his true passion project, Frankenstein, because he's a massive Frankenstein mm-hmm. nut. And it's possible we might see him. I think it's called The Best Movies Never Made or Best Script Ever. They did like a reading of the script he was working on, which sounded like not a movie I would expect a studio to give $90 million to. So I, on one hand, I'm not surprised that movie didn't get made, but on the other, we did get this, which is pretty damn good.
just last year, the ILM VFX test for the At the Mountains of Madness film came out, and oh boy, it looked so good. I cannot believe they couldn't just agree to whatever he had said.
I've seen a lot of the artwork and stuff, and like if you're interested in having this Lovecraftian horror picture, yes, it would have been amazing. Would it have made the money that Universal would need for it to work? I don't know. Maybe in the post it world, possibly.
But at the time, I think he was still maybe a little untested. Pan's Labyrinth did very well critically, but both it and Hellboy 2, I think, kind of underperformed for what they were, which is very VFX and other effects heavy films. And nerds like me really enjoy those movies. But yeah, he joined up after that film fell through to do this one, and of course added a lot of what he wanted to see growing up, enjoying Ultraman, enjoying Godzilla movies. And then in the 90s, I think Del Toro said he was a Evangelion fan, just adding all those elements into this universe. And yeah, it really does feel like a love letter to several genres at once while being its own
thing. Yes.
The filming began in around this time, November of 2011, and continued until April of the following year. So 6 months for a film like this, it feels like a long time. But then originally they had no plans for a 3D adaptation, and was not that they basically said, Del Toro said that it just wasn't going to be possible because this wasn't a film that would be from like the ground level of the kaiju. It really is like the kaiju and the monsters are your main figures in a lot of those fights. So he just had a inability, I think, to conceptualize that. But eventually they did convert it to 3D after the fact, which, I'm sure didn't hurt its bottom line, but it's an expensive process, you know, so that definitely added to the budget of this film, which is estimated to be upwards of $200 million, which is pretty big. What do you have to say about the plot, Miles? It is a long film by, I think, a few standards, in both it is over 2 hours, but also takes place over several years. The first part of the film before the title card is 17 minutes long, and it's basically a flashback to like 5 years before the main film.
Yeah. It's kind of a blessing and a curse, it being kind of an origin movie, because like we have to take all this time so that we can world build. And sometimes that's what you need for some of these blockbusters. You watch some older movies from the 70s that are considered great, and you know, they take a while to get going. Like even like Chinatown, it takes a while to get going, you know? Mm-hmm. And once you're in the world, once you have been kind of brought up to speed, it's just a matter of like, okay, now let's see what's going on. And then the plot's actually very simple. It's for whatever reason, and even within the movie, you're like, this is real dumb.
Yeah, monsters come out of the ocean.
No. The real dumb part is, oh, we're just gonna build a wall. We're decommissioning the Jaegers, and we are building walls. And
yeah,
we're never given a really good reason as to why that's thought is gonna be a winner, because we immediately see a kaiju just ripped that wall like nothing.
What's interesting is the kaiju in this movie are treated kind of like hurricanes. They're given the
category numbers
1 through 5, designation, and they are named in the film as well, like we name storms, but
but they're given more like, you know, Leatherback or, you know, Knife Head. They're given kind of like very
cool
like
names.
Grunt. No, can you
imagine if they just went through the alphabet and were like, all right, your name is Gene Hurricane or Kaiju Gene Kaiju.
I mean, at the same time, it would have been kind of fun if there was some sort of like when they had the Knife Head one. It's like, come on, calm Giron. Just do it.
You know, something I didn't write down in my notes, but we talked about that, I think, with those episodes of where we looked at the Gamera movies. The designer for Knife Head in this film did not make that a conscious decision to design it anywhere close to Giron, which I found surprising because it's such a specific kind of
it is, look. But also like the idea of like a creature having a knife for a head is like, you know, kind of ubiquitous.
When you take a look at what it was based on, it's based on the goblin shark, which is kind of a knife headed looking deep sea denizen, and they took certain elements for the kaiju in this film from animals, but they all have an alien kind of look to them, and we'll talk about why in a little bit. But
yeah,
as at the point they start building the walls, it does feel like this universe is relegated to the fact that they're going to have kaiju attacks, but is treating them like storms. And it's like, you know, we were just in a series of hurricanes that knocked out your power and, you know, threatened the lives of many people. And some people just don't evacuate, you know, when a hurricane's bearing down.
I mean, there is that, but like, we are given this whole thing of like, oh, the Jaeger program, we're shutting it down. And like, on one hand, like if they had given you like an actual reason, mm-hmm. like I felt like that's the most paper thin thing, and like even if you're putting on a veil of like, oh, this is, you know, these guys are like these, you know, kind of, you get the idea that they kind of conservative Republican types, but like they're not giving you any reasons,
doesn't last very long.
It's
hilarious. It did remind me of Attack on Titan, where the majority of strategy for humanity is to build giant walls against these giants, but
to keep in mind this is like three years before that became a real buzzword type of situation. But yeah, it does have that kind of an Attack on Titan. They're trying to build these giant coastal walls so that the kaiju, you know, can roam around, but they're not going to mess with us. And after his brother dies in a rescue/extermination mission gone wrong, Riley Beckett is drops off the face of the earth. He's in Alaska currently helping build one of these walls. and kind of goes where the shifts are and purposefully kind of stays out of any sort of kind of, he's trying to keeps off the grid, which is kind of where the movie really starts, because yeah, Idris Elba's Marshall Pentecost,
the names in this movie are
so awesome. I love it so much.
I mean, we already mentioned Hannibal Chow, which he says he took the name from his favorite journal. Szechuan restaurant in New York. It's like, okay. All right.
Marshall's great. Played beautifully by Idris Elba, who I think I read that, like, because he was working with him for At the Mountains of Madness, like, Tom Cruise was originally supposed to play Marshall, but had scheduling conflicts and couldn't do it.
Oh, I thought he was going to be the Raleigh Beckett, but that makes more sense. But, oh, boy, yeah, no, there's no replacing Idris Elba.
No, the thing is,
he might be the best part of this movie.
Look, Idris Elba, he lifts everything that he's in. Like, he's even one of the best characters in the Fast franchise. Like, and when that man talks, there is a gravity. And Del Toro was so smart to cast him, because there is a monologue that has been, I mean, there's a log line that is now in the annals of, like, cinema history in terms of, like, famous lines. You know, today we're canceling the apocalypse.
It's a big line. Yeah, with Release the Kraken for kaiju movies. And I don't remember if it was in the trailer. I think it's
beyond that, because, like, Release the Kraken was, like, such a meme thing. But, like, to me, this is up there with, like, today we celebrate our Independence Day with Bill Pullman's. You know, this is, like, Idris Elba gives that kind of performance. And, like, even though it's, like, you see it meme to death, when you watch the movie and he says, today we are canceling the apocalypse, you are right there with everyone else going, like, yeah.
Yes, indeedy, we are.
He just has that kind of charismatic performance to him.
It's so funny that part of the movie comes after, probably the only real nitpicky thing I have about this film is the pacing is off in parts.
Agreed.
Where this does feel like, you know, the film that did it most recently was The Batman by Matt Reeves.
I recently rewatched The Batman. Do not say a bad thing about that film. Amazing.
It has a 4-act structure instead of a 3-act structure, which really messes with
movie,
you.
But see, that movie gets 3 hours to do it, so, like, it works.
Well, it's about, yeah, this one only has 10 hours, only 20 minutes, 10 hours, 10 minutes.
With, not 10.
Oh, sorry, two hours and 10
minutes. I wish it had 10 hours.
Yeah, no, so it's very quick, but after probably, I would say, the main, like, fight, like, the thing that you saw in all the trailers, which is this Hong Kong battle between two kaiju and 3 or 4 giant robots, which is like a good 20 minutes long. It is like a central thesis of this film. You think that's the end of the movie, because it's like, oh my gosh, how are they gonna top that fight? There's still another half hour, 40 minutes in the runtime. You know, that was
right,
felt like the climax of the film, and then it just continues on, and it has another very interesting kaiju battle under the ocean, but it's just not as good.
I do think this movie needed another 30 minutes so it could flesh out more stuff. And I'm not always, you know, especially we live in a time where, like, 2.5 hours is now kind of common. And this hour is, two hours and 12 minutes. But I really think that you could have easily mined another 30 minutes to, one, let us get to know the other pilots a little bit better and see them kind of in action. I wanted a handful of set pieces of some Jaeger versus kaiju action, but not a lot, not as much as you would think. And most of that is because we are moving the pieces so that we can get to, you know, Gypsy Danger, which is the name of Raleigh's podcast, Jaeger.
Giant Robo. Yeah.
And we haven't even talked about our other main character.
Yes. In, I think, one of the actresses, Rinko Kikuchi's first.
She's so good.
Films. And she would go on to do first English films at the very least.
You have seen her before this.
In another kaiju movie or?
Nope. This is going back again to our more nerd days. She is in Survive Style 5 Plus.
Oh, right. Yes, that is a very fun film.
I love that movie so much. She's a phenomenal actress. I don't think she often in her English speaking stuff gets as many good roles as she should. I think she's back to doing more Japanese films, and I think is going to pop up in a film that we're going to watch
hopefully in
a while if we can get access to it.
She was in 22's What to Do with a Dead Kaiju, which, oh boy, I do have the Japanese DVD. I'm just hoping with the resurgence of Godzilla films that we get a more localized release that we can enjoy. But she's great. I feel like if they really leaned into her and Charlie Hunnam's character's relationship a little bit more, this movie would have a little more
that need another 15 runway. Minutes because there's a weird vibe of like romance that's implied.
Yeah, and I just don't think we get it on screen.
We don't, and they were very smart not to have them kiss.
Yeah, because it would have felt weird. Her story is really about her relationship with her father, who is Idris Elba, her adoptive father, after her parents are killed in a kaiju attack. And that story goes on very well because he's very protective of her, and she is likewise very worried about him throughout the film. Hilariously enough, spoilers, Miles, can I give you a spoiler for the next movie?
I know she's in it.
Well, she is, but also Idris Elba's son is one of the main characters, a person that we didn't know existed in this.
So film. I was worried that was going to be the case. Are you talking about John Boyega's character?
John Boyega, I believe.
So whenever I saw that trailer, I was like, I hope he's not supposed to be the son of Idris Elba. And I honestly, until today, I did not know that was the case because I still haven't seen that movie. And I'm very bummed about that.
Well, it's hilarious. It's like the, gosh, when did this, the reverse of this happened in, I guess, the Star Wars universe, where it's like, oh man, I hope Rey isn't Palpatine or somehow related.
That was like one of the original like rumors that I was like all in on. Like a lot of people were like, oh no, and John Boyega's character, Finn's going to be the son of Mace Windu. I'm like, stop doing that. Stop that.
No. Hollywood is that dumb, and that is
what I know they are.
Yeah, Del Toro, I don't think, wrote any part of the script for the second movie. But I will say, for the most part, I really do like the casting. I like the
characters the cast's great. Of
this movie. There are some very odd decisions, though, because I have it here in my notes. Rinko Kikuchi is 8 years younger than Idris Elba. And I understand that like he's not her biological father, but
she wouldn't like
he would have been okay. Like an 18-year-old Jaeger.
Look, we have 28-year-olds portraying 15-year-olds all the time. It is what it is.
The other thing is the Australian Jaeger pilots, Max Martini, the father of the duo, is only 14 years older than Robert Kaczynski, who plays his son, and they felt more like brothers than Charlie Hunnam and his brother. Like, they felt very brotherly in this movie, but I thought that was a little weird. Maybe something in the Pacific Rim universe makes people age better. if you're a kaiju pilot, you age at a different rate. Like, I can understand with Idris Elba, like, he's looked the exact same for like 30 years for me, watching him since like The Wire days,
right? So, I love, we haven't even talked about them yet, Bern Gorman and Charlie Day as the kaiju research scientists.
Yeah, so they're pretty much our comic relief in this movie.
I would absolutely have watched like a 30 like minute like sitcom show about those two guys in a lab together.
They're great. Easily. Sometimes they feel like really secondary to the actual plot going on, but like Charlie Day's character is kind of a mad scientist and linking his brain up to the kaiju to discover, you know, information about them, which seems like need to know information, but
at the same time, it's like not. It's super, super dangerous. No, it is need to know. I mean, it's
well, at the end,
finale of the movie.
Yeah, they realize it's like, oh, well, we're not going to be able to get the bomb through unless you ride a kaiju through, which is hilarious. But yes, their stuff is the most interesting in the movie because it does feel like, oh wow, you're finally in a decade of fighting these kaiju, you're finally finding out something about them in this movie, which is good. But yeah, their characters are named after mathematicians and scientists, and they have a very fun relationship with one another. And Charlie Day, well, I you know, spoiler, Rinko Kikuchi comes back in the second film, but I think Charlie Day is like the only actor that is like a main character in the second movie. Sense. It takes place a number of years later, and obviously some of them have died and some of them have moved on or not Jaeger pilots at the time. But yeah, the cast is great. I feel like the music of this movie is great. It is done by,
it's good. It's very kind of standard Hollywood blockbuster, but like not in a bad way. Like it's competent. It's not memorable.
Well, you've heard the soundtracks of Ramin Djawadi multiple times, because before this he did work on Clash of the Titans. He did parts of that soundtrack, but also he did the music for Iron Man and Game of Thrones, which was around the same time. 2013 is when Game of Thrones
much
started
better time. Much more memorable music in those.
We have more to work with the fantasy genre, but he also has gone on to be
House. I mean, you say that, but I've asked John Williams about his sci-fi contributions.
Yeah, that's the thing. There are parts that really stand out in this movie, and like all the different countries kaiju kind of like have their own motifs, but they don't have that much screen time, which is a major problem. But let's get to the meat of what I think this episode is going to be about, which is, let's talk about the kaiju. Let's talk about the robots, Miles, the specifics of the.
Yeah, it's one of the things I kind of criticize the most about this. Again, we don't get to spend a lot of time with the other robots. I would have liked a little bit more kind of like in broad daylight with some of the other robots, goodness. Like, you know, the Russian robot that's supposed to be this big brawler, and the Chinese robot that's got three of them. And so it has three arms, and like they're all these cool ideas. And we see them briefly in the darkness of night. And I think my biggest problem with this movie is, like, I wish the designs of the Jaegers had been a little more visually varied on screen.
That's, you know, this movie gets that complaint a lot. Legendary's 2014 Godzilla movie gets that complaint a lot. It's a lot of nighttime kaiju battles, or battles obscured by rain or some other effects.
Funny because it doesn't bother me in those. Like, if it's a design that I know, like, I don't, like, I know a lot of people complain. You're right, because James Rolfe, Angry Video Game Nerd, like, that's his biggest complaint about the MonsterVerse movies prior to the Kong ones, is that, like, oh yeah, it's always in the darkness. I'm like, that is not my problem. I know the Godzilla design. I can see it in the broad daylight. Mm-hmm. It's fine. These robots, like, I need to see them. Like, I don't know these things. And
that's the thing. I would love to, like, you get them introduced at least in daytime. And so much of like the tests that they do are like also underground. It's like, why can't you just take them outside to do some like warm up? I feel like we missed a mech versus mech kind of tutorial early in the film.
Oh, a little robot jocks, if you will.
A little robot jocks. Yeah. And it can also give a reason why some of these mech pilots are a little at odds with one another. Maybe something, you know, happened in training. But yeah, the first battle, the first, you know, 15 minutes of the film is Knifehead versus
Gypsy Danger.
Yes, which I'll talk about in just a minute. But that's at night. We do get to see the robot after it's destroyed kind of in the daylight. And then Hong Kong's at night. And I think it's during the day when the final acts underwater bit, but it's so dark underwater. It's like, it might as well be at night.
And yeah.
They're bright, colorful robots, but all their colors really
feel muted.
Yeah. They're very muted, very dark in these scenes. Well, it's such a bummer.
You know, another problem I have with a lot of the robots is that all the designs across the board, no matter where the robots are from, feel very distinctly American. I don't know what it is about American film and comics that like want to have these big blocky robots, and like not a single one looked like a Gundam. And I mean, I know that sounds like I'm making a joke, but like 100% some other country would have had something that was kind of Gundam looking, or like Evangelion looking, like have a little more personality. All of these kind of feel like steampunky designs, and I don't understand why.
Well, so let's talk about them a little more in depth. The primary mech, Gypsy Danger, Del Toro talks about in interviews, is named after the Gypsy aircraft engine, which is in turn named after the Gypsy Moth. And it was made to kind of emulate World War II bomber kind of craft, and has kind of nose cone art on the chest, and the chest also kind of looks like a nose in bits, or like an aircraft's engine. The Romani people, Miles, consider that G word very much a slur. Online communities have suggested changing the name to G Danger, just Danger, or Lady Danger. But if you're going to go so far as to change it in, you know, like future iterations, I would say take something from World War II where it's supposed to be from. I would suggest like Hellcat Danger or other aircraft like Mustang Danger. That sounds almost too American.
Mustang Very Danger, much. But Mustang Danger sounds like a 1980s like Japanese anime being translated or localized in America.
Mustang Danger,
like a Battle for the Planets kind of situation. We're like, oh, here's Robotech, here's Mustang Danger, here's Roy, you know.
But I do like the name Gypsy Danger a lot.
It does have a ring to it. I mean, I think that's the main reason why people have kept it.
All of the mechs though have two names, and it is interesting if they are so diverse. Their countries are almost making their own mechs, to my knowledge.
That's what I gathered as well.
In the next film, I think there's like a unified like government in the Pacific that like makes mechs, but they all have a two name kind of element. So the Australian one is Striker Eureka. The Russian is Cherno Alpha, and the Chinese is Crimson Typhoon, which feels like the coolest or most theme appropriate for the mechs. And we do get that. I mean, we see a ton of other Jaegers and kind of flashbacks or like news programs, but the other main one is Idris Elba's mech that we see in the flashback is called Coyote Tango, which I love that name, I think, the most because it does feel like military letter abbreviations. You know? It feels like something that they would actually name, like maybe it's an production. I know,
like, you say that, but like now, like all I think about is like Foxtrot Uniform Charlie Kilo.
Hey, but yeah, design wise, I'm with you. It does feel like they're very similar. Cherno Alpha, the Russian one, has like elements that make it look like a nuclear cooling tower, which is like, come on, you know, like that's just so simple, so silly.
Yeah, I do like some of it. To put it in like almost like Street Fighter terms, like it kind of felt like Zangief, like this is big, burly, yes, like robot. And I do like that they all have different personalities and styles of combat. I wish I saw that visually a little bit more. And part of the problem is we don't get to see these robots in action much.
Yeah, that's the main thing. The main ones that we're talking about here, like I said, I really just feel like we needed a training mission. Take time away from that first kaiju fight and instead give it to the mechs, because it would have been more impactful. One, if we had known the pilots themselves, but two, the mechs themselves. And that is something that I do think they fix in the sequel. It's been a while since I've seen Uprising, but I feel like we get more of the mechs in that movie. But let's talk about the kaiju, because that is the name of the podcast, Miles. What did you think about kaiju design for this film?
I thought they were pretty good. I do wish, like, I like that they're like, especially knowing that where these things are originating from, the designs of them make sense.
Yeah.
That said, I do wish there was a little bit more of an individual feel to them.
I'm right there with you. And really the only thing I need is more color differentiation. And it's the same thing, yes, as
they're all kind of blues and grays. And then they got the kind of like the sometimes they have a flourish of orange and some of their stuff. But like it's mostly just blues and grays.
It's another problem I think they solve in the sequel and Pacific Rim the Black. But if you're trying to sell, the Black
might be my favorite Pacific Rim thing, actually. It's so good.
That's crazy. But yeah, they you know, all the kaiju in this film are supposedly cloned or bred from like the same kind of stock kaiju, right, and then given different abilities, but for the most part they all have a design element that ties them together. But at the same time, very interestingly, the design process from Del Toro's team made them so that they should, even though they're all art and CGI, they could be creatures that could be pseudomated. So they tried to keep the human silhouette in the kaiju designs, which I absolutely love.
That is very cool.
And you really see it in like Leatherback, who is kind of like an ape. But he was
very Kong-like.
Yes. They kept alien designs, but made kind of animal motifs for a lot of these creatures, which I enjoyed. They're just sometimes where it's like the design, especially for, and we'll go through the kaijus here. Otachi is, I feel like, the main kaiju. It's the main one along with Leatherback that attacks Hong Kong. And I think we get the most battle time, screen time for him. It starts off as a ground battle, and he has like an acid spitting attack. He's very reptilian, maybe dragon-like in some ways. But then after about 10 minutes of fighting, it sprouts bat-like wings, very like almost Rodan style wings. I was like, what? Why weren't you using this before? It seems like it would have given you, all you have to do is like fly up and spit acid at these robots that you're fighting. And I really like Otachi, but I feel like that was kind of silly. We get two more category four kaiju in the final fight of the movie, Skunner and Raiju. And I can barely remember these guys because they're in the movie so little.
Honestly, that's one of the biggest bummers for me is like we're like kind of given this ominous feeling. Oh, there's a Cat 5 on its way. We've never had a Cat 5 before.
Absolutely.
And it's like lame. It's there for 15 seconds.
Slattern, everyone's favorite.
And it's such a bummer because like I love the idea of like, oh, we got it. We are in trouble. And you don't get that vibe. And honestly, the Cat 5 seems like, honestly, like indecipherable from the other fours. Like, it doesn't seem like a big deal at all.
It's like Ghidorah level size. But the thing is, because it takes place underwater, it suffers the problem where they're hard to scale these creatures. There's no ground level humans running away. There's no buildings to compare them to. There's like underwater rocks and like things like that. But it's like, I would say 1.5 times the size of the category fours. It's pretty lame. Another spoiler warning. There's Cat Fives in the sequel film, and I think they're done much better.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the most recognizable kaiju and my favorite is Knifehead. And he's, you know, killed off in like the first 10 minutes. And maybe that's just because I love Giron. But we see some others. The first kaiju that attacks humanity is like a cat two or three. It's very small. Trespasser, and he's got kind of like a knife head. And then the other one we see a lot is Onibaba, which is the crab style kaiju that we see in Mako's flashbacks, which are great and maybe one of my favorite. I can say that's maybe my favorite part of the movie is when we get into her mind, into her flashback, because storytelling wise it's probably where this movie does the best is we get to from these characters' memories, like how they're experiencing each other's handshake, this neural handshake, and getting into each other's memories. And it's cool. It's kind of like a dreamlike sequence. It's kind of a little holodeck-ish. Do you have a favorite part of the movie, Miles? A favorite scene? Or
I mean, I did earlier talk a little bit about Marshall's big speech. I also love it feels very Morpheus and Neo are fighting in the Matrix. The scene where she and Raleigh are having their little like
that stick sequence
is great. Honestly, the weird thing is like despite a lot of the problems this movie has with like trying to put so much into this, you know, 2 hour and 12 minute movie is like all the character stuff that they do have is fantastic. Like really, really fantastic. You mentioned like seeing her memories and then even seeing the visual of how the handshake works because you see like her experience all the stuff with his brother and there's this bit that Del Toro talks about how the harness work was like really physically demanding for the actors.
And it's crazy how physical the inside of the mech sets were, you know.
He says that all the actors were destroyed physically except for Rinko. And he says, you know, she was the only one that never complained. And I asked Rinko her secret, and she said, I think of gummy bears and flowers. And Del Toro goes, I try to do that in my life now.
Sounds pretty good. Yeah. Yeah. The some of the shooting days they had for this film sound pretty brutal, rough. Pretty yeah. long for this kind of film. There's so much of the film that is existing in the digital world, you know, the monsters, the kaiju, some of the setting, but they built so many sets, like, you know, the city streets of Hong Kong and
Hannibal Charlie Chow's. Day's like B plot of going through Hong Kong to meet so Hannibal Chow is like one of my favorite parts of the movie. It's so good.
Yeah, he's really good. I'm happy to say he's fun in his return as well. But there's just so many nerd elements of this film and so many weird things that just don't need to be in it. Like there is a Evangelion like. You know how the Evangelions are kind of like shot up through like an elevator system to the ground. Mm-hmm. For some reason, they load the pilots into the heads of mechs and then slide them down like 20 stories and attach them to the bodies. And it's like, why aren't the heads always attached to the bodies? Like, why is this a thing? It's because Del Toro, I'm pretty sure, it's because he loves Evangelion.
Oh, I mean, I believe that. I really love that Ella McClain is the AI voice of Gypsy Danger.
And it just, she's the voice of GLaDOS from the Portal games. They said they changed her voice, like digitally altered it somewhat.
Absolutely not.
It sounds 1,000%
like 100% GLaDOS. He did that on purpose. And like, I don't care what he says, like that was 100% on purpose.
100% sounds like her. Yeah. And boy, howdy, there's a lot of stuff that beggars belief physics wise. And they talk about how, you know, in doing the CGI for the film, they needed to make sure that the monsters had like a weight to them. And that's a problem you have in all CGIs. You don't want these, you know, supposedly huge creatures to feel. So they were looking at the physics even of like, if a giant kaiju was walking through a cityscape, you know, it would like break or like shake windows, just like all that wind being displaced. And they talked about how, you know, especially that Hong Kong sequence, which is the only city fight in the film, how important that was that to get right. And then in about, it feels like 10 seconds, one of the kaiju flies the mech into outer space with leathery wings, Miles. I was just like, why is this? How is this happening? This doesn't seem real. But the mechs are super light because it only takes about 12 Chinooks to fly them into place. That's the other thing. It's not like,
yeah,
a science fiction vehicle. They're just helicopters that are able to move the mechs. And that's the other thing. They have like, well, I guess they don't. They don't have any like jet propulsion on the mechs themselves, right? They're really ground-based mechs for the most part. They use the chest, you know, kind of cannon thing on Danger to slow its...
Well, but the thing is like that, I mean, like, they can't even travel like the helicopters or whatever. Mm-hmm. Also, the idea that a handful of helicopters could lift that thing is laughable.
Yeah, but that's what I just said. It's someone on IMDb, I think, did the math and was like, it would take about 100 times more. It would take like 500 helicopters to lift.
But the fact that like Gypsy Danger has to be dropped in these situations is it doesn't make any sense.
It feels like if you're making them, you would, you know, make a, some more tech to have the mobile, like, I don't know, jet boots, you know, like a lot of giant robots have.
Like the Gundam.
And that's the other thing, is they have this knockdown, drag-out fight in Hong Kong where they pull...
You assume giant... like Gypsy's like down for the count, basically, after that fight. Well,
they have this fight and they pull a giant tanker out of the ocean to use as like a club to fight the
problems I had with that sequence, and that tanker didn't break almost immediately.
Well, it breaks pretty quickly, but it's like, okay.
No, it does not.
They're using what they can in this battle. But once Itachi takes them to the outer atmosphere, that's when they're like, oh, we totally forgot. We have a giant sword that we could have been using this entire time.
Bro,
and they pull it out. And
okay,
and,
so the sword as the last action of a mech is a tried and true thing. So I get why they want to save it for last. I get why Del Toro wanted to have that moment. But you cannot have your pilots go, oh, by the way, we also have this thing.
Yeah, like, well, it was a surprise this, to the audience.
This ain't Power Rangers. Like, you go in there and you need to have that sword drawn to take these guys out immediately. Well,
I mean, they use it after the fact in the next battle between Skarner and Raiju.
After we saw it, after the big, like, look what we got.
I think Raiju is absolutely bifurcated by the sword. I'm like, why did they not use that immediately? Because we do see some of the other kaiju using...
They were using Super Sentai rules.
yeah, exactly. We do see Crimson Typhoon has, like, blade hands. And it's like, okay, they all have some kind of blade element. Striking Eureka has... almost like punching daggers come out of the back of their hand. So they all have some other capabilities, but yeah. Why are you using a giant tanker if you have a sword? And I don't know, maybe the sword breaks easily. Who knows?
But not as easily as that tanker.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's so many good things about this movie, though. I do feel like we could talk four hours.
I feel like I've spent more time kind of criticizing the movie as opposed to like just enjoying everything, because like this movie is such a joy to watch. Like I think the thing is like when especially when you have a podcast like ours, like when you have something that you really love, you spend more time talking about its flaws so that you don't come across of like, oh no, I'm not gonna like just be glowing for 90 minutes or however long our show is. But I mean,
Del Toro is such an otaku. He was a huge fan of anime and tokusatsu shows that he was able to get his hands on in Mexico growing up. He cited Tetsujin, what is the American name for this?
Gigantor
in his
which makes more sense because Gigantor does have that kind of tin man look. It's not very like the mecha that we have known since like 1979.
Oh, that's the other thing I want to mention. I really do. I think I should get an art book of this series, but supposedly the production team had over 100 Jaegers and Kaiju designed for this film. And every week had like, they voted someone off the island that wouldn't make it into the movie.
I feel like if I had that access to like all those concept pieces, I would just get mad.
Yeah, it's like, why didn't you use this? But yeah, some of the best ones must have gotten through. And,
Well, the seal bothers me is if that's true, and this is what we ended up with. That can't be right. You can't tell me that there was like 96 worse designs than what we got on screen.
The movie is dedicated to the memories of Ray Harryhausen and Ishiro Honda, which I think shows you
exactly where he's coming from. 100%.
Yeah, who this movie is for, and this is for the kaiju fans that I think would understand all these references in the movie. But there's additional credits at the end. Del Toro thanks James Cameron, David Cronenberg, Alfonso Cuarón, who I don't think I knew of his work at the time.
Wait, really?
In 2013?
Orphanage had already been out. So had Prisoner of Azkaban.
That year he did Gravity. But
he also did Children of Men?
I was about to say, I definitely did see Children of Men in theaters. And
like, I'm pretty sure you knew who he was beforehand.
Alejandro Gonzalez Inarritu, who's another Mexican director and contemporary of Guillermo del Toro, who I definitely didn't know who he was because I don't think Birdman was out yet. But
no, Cronenberg's the weird one to throw out there. I mean, I guess you could say like, oh, well, yeah, he did the handshake is kind of body horror influenced. I guess maybe. No, but like,
I think these are just people that have
that he likes. He's inspired being, Del Toro. He's being Kojima.
Well, like I said, well, speaking of Kojima,
yeah, and you had 100% seen that director's work before. He because that the he did Babel. And 21 Grams.
I didn't see Babel.
Oh,
I don't think I knew of them quite so much. I think both of them are household names for me now comparatively. But in 2013, I just probably wasn't dialed as into it. But speaking of Kojima, this has gotten praise from other directors and game directors. Rian Johnson was a huge fan, and Hideo Kojima called this the ultimate otaku film.
I was going to say, him naming like Cronenberg and stuff, like it feels like a very Kojima move. and yeah, no, Kojima loving this is not a shocker.
Movie didn't really do that great. It only made $100 million.
Fine.
It did okay. It did basically same numbers, like I said, as Clash of the Titans, which is surprising. I understand that movie has some more name recognition beforehand, but it did fine in North America. It did very well internationally. And like I said, this movie released in literally every film market and had almost as big a draw in China that it did in North America. This did very well in China.
It was considered to be an international hit. It didn't do super well here. Kind of like Warcraft.
Yes, it's a very similar situation. But unlike Warcraft, this movie did eventually get a sequel, and we're still waiting on Warcraft.
Are we waiting on it, though, bud? Are we?
Well, I'm not waiting on it, but China
certainly. I saw that movie, and I love Duncan Jones. He's a phenomenal director. That movie is not great.
Is that also Charlie Hunnam in that movie?
Is it?
I think it is. I think I did look that up beforehand.
No.
Is it not? Who's the main actor of Warcraft?
In Warcraft? Gosh, it's been so long. Travis Fimmel.
He's a Charlie Hunnam type. You'll give me that, right?
Yeah, no. He's the guy that plays Ragnar in Vikings.
Oh, okay.
Which he looks a lot like Charlie Hunnam. I agree. No, you're not wrong there.
This movie... it's got pretty okay reviews across the board. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 72% critics, 77% popcorn. The cinema score for when the movie came out, though, was an A-. So that's people walking out of the theaters grading it, you know, A+ to F, which is pretty good, I want to say.
Yeah, the people who saw this movie did really like it a lot.
Yes, and like we said, this movie does get a sequel 5 years later, Pacific Rim Uprising. And then you've not seen Uprising, but you have seen Pacific Rim The Black?
Yes, love The Black.
That came, I think, 4 years later.
Yeah, it was a little bit later.
2021 or something like that. They just announced this year that Legendary Entertainment is developing a prequel television series as well. So we are getting a new Pacific Rim project every 3 to 5 years, which
I guess I need to see how the sequel works. I don't know if I'm super interested in a prequel. I am excited to see what the writer, the showrunner, who is the writer of Arrival.
Yes. Erica.
And for those who. Yes. Also a very, very popular internet horror story called the Dionai House. That was like a multimedia novel that was told across like several blogs and stuff.
Oh,
it was a thing that came out like from 04 to 06. And it like became super, super viral at one point. And like almost every Halloween, I try to find a way to read it because it's really, really good. He's supposed to do a film based on it, but it fell apart.
Eric Kaiser did some terrible the reboot for Nightmare on Elm Street, and it wasn't terrible, but it was gutted.
Well, that was a co-write, so who knows.
the prequel of The Thing, which was, I don't think it was his fault. I think the script was fine, but he wrote screenplay for The Arrival. I had a
conversation about that movie last night. They were like, yeah, apparently they had filmed that movie with all practical effects, and at the 11th hour the studio came in and was like, no, it's all CGI now.
They gutted it, really.
And I was like, so is the movie itself good other than that? And they're like, oh, yeah, because I haven't seen the 2011 thing. I had no interest, even though I love Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
I think it's worth watching, but it's such a bummer. It's like, oh, this, you know, in a world where we get all these remakes and reboots, I feel like I really want that one to succeed. But yeah, I'm very optimistic about a potential TV series after, you know, Apple just get done with the Monarch.
Yeah.
What's the name of the show? Legacy? No.
No, it's called Monarch.
No, it's not.
You talking about the Godzilla show on Apple?
Yeah, isn't it?
It's called Monarch.
Oh, Legacy of Monsters is the subtitle I was thinking about.
Yeah. Yes. No, but it's called Monarch.
It is just called Monarch. But after that success.
You had me worried for a second. I was like, am I having a stroke?
Well, I was like, no, there's more to it, isn't there?
Yeah, it is Monarch Legacy of Monsters. But
so we we have a lot of potential kaiju television, live action television, which is not something we've ever gotten before down the pipeline. So I'm excited. I do think I would like to see more of this universe. Let's get to our ratings, Miles, because we have beat down on this movie a little bit, but for personal enjoyment.
I like I said, I feel bad about it, but I'm also like, no, because I'm such a huge fan of this movie, I feel like I have to like spend some time poking at it too.
But that, I really do think that's all of Del Toro's films. They are all so innately rewatchable, watchable. Oh, yeah. And the first time you see them, they are an experience. Every single one of them, unlike really anything you've gotten before, whether he's mm-hmm. doing horror or superheroes or giant monsters, it's all good. Or in the case
of Shape of Creature Water, of the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, I was about to say a redux of that film that got him an Academy Award.
So good.
This movie definitely drags in some places, but it is so rewatchable. I feel the first time I watched it, it was a roller coaster. And after I got off, the credits ended, I felt like that runtime was super quick. It did lag a little bit on this rewatch, but the world building, the spectacle that is presented in here is just so good. It really does remind me specifically of Hellboy 2, of just how beautiful his filmmaking can be. And he's one of those directors that I really do, you know, that I think they chide him on set because everything has to go through Del Toro. You know, he's kind of like Stanley Kubrick in that way. He doesn't delegate tasks to anyone. Like everything you see on the screen has been approved by him in some way, which is just, you know, it makes for very slow filmmaking, but very beautiful filmmaking because he knows what he likes. I love this film. I feel like this is made specifically for otaku kaiju nerds, and I count myself very much in that camp. So this was made for me. It's a 10 out of 10 for my personal enjoyment.
So I always struggle with this one, with this movie, because like part of me, for just the ride and the vibes, I want to give it a 10 out of 10. There is some stuff that kind of takes me out sometimes. Some of the things that I talked about, like the fact that, like, you know, we go on this disjointed journey and we don't get to see the kaiju for very much. You know, as soon as everything was ready to go, we were kind of jumping into the main story, and we go from, oh, Gypsy Danger, like they can't even sync up right. And then all of a sudden they are syncing up. They're in the fight. We don't really have that build up to them being able to sync together, which is a bummer. I feel like that's an important part to put in. That said, I mean, this movie is phenomenal. Like for every criticism I have, like at the same time, like this movie looks great. The designs are good, even if I want them to be better. Like you have, you know, $200 million going into giant robots fighting monsters from a just pure enjoyment from the cast you have. Like, and every single actor is just chewing up any scene they get. Yeah, everything on here is firing all cylinders just from a pure enjoyment perspective. I'm so torn. I'm going to give it a 10 out of 10 for my personal enjoyment. I'm always waffling a little bit there. Like if I could give a 9.5, I would.
Yeah, and this one I really do feel like that 10 out of 10 is from the first time I watched it, because the second time, like, yes, I said, it wasn't as good, but it really was. Well, it's just,
I think you notice a couple of the, you know, kind of warts and all situation. You like, you see those things and you're like, oh, this movie is still amazing. It's still a phenomenal experience. And like, having watched this movie, you know, again, despite all of my criticisms, if I'm just talking about how much I enjoyed the ride, yeah, it's fantastic. Like, you cannot get any better in 2013. We will get better, but I mean, you know, we
in 2013 mentioned this at the or just like in this season,
in this season. Yes.
Sorry. Oh, I was about to say, because I don't think Big Ass Spider is going to do it.
Oh, are you kidding me? Oh, man. No. One of J.J. Abrams' favorite guys in the league. Of course he is. No. But I do think something that we like briefly mentioned at the top of the show is what, like, the idea of whether or not this really did kickstart the kaiju boom. And even if it's not responsible for it, it is certainly a harbinger of it.
Yes. I mean, you've got Cloverfield and you've got this movie, and they're really the two only like original kaiju properties that I think you can point to that are giving us all the movies that we're getting today. And they're just because they're so imaginative. They're reigniting, I think, the passion for what those kind of films can be.
I think they're setting it up. I still think that 2014's Godzilla is the watershed moment. Mm-hmm. No, even though that movie was somewhat tepidly received by some,
yeah,
I think without that one really tipping the scales of like showing that people are interested in this and named monsters. And that's the big thing, because yeah, otherwise, yeah, you could have had it like on more versions of Big Ass Spider or something like that. And no, this is a 10 for in terms of like my actual enjoyment of it. Let's talk about the technical aspects. I feel like we have a little bit more to say in terms of like maybe more nits to pick here.
Yeah. And to be fair, I think I was originally going to give this a 9 out of 10. Just from our conversation, I want to drop it down another notch, but I don't think I can. I think this film suffers. The only place it really suffers is its technical aspect. And parts of that being like maybe some aspects of the script were chopped up or rushed a little bit. But like right. I said, it is the muted color tones, like, you know, coming from Hellboy 2, which is like such a beautifully lush, colorful world and universe. This is a very dark, kind of bummer, muted, you know, battle scenes. And I'm with James Rolfe. Yeah, I think this movie and even 2014's Godzilla, I would have loved to see some more daytime sequences. And it doesn't have to be battles with the kaiju. Like I said, it could have just been one training sequence with the robots, with the giant mech.
Yeah, I definitely think we should have had like a Robot Jocks moment there for sure.
Would have done wonders. But yeah, pacing-wise, I do feel like this movie feels like it's over after that Hong Kong battle, and there's still so much more to it. There's like 40 minutes left, which feels wild. And finally, my last little nitpick here, which is why I'm giving it a 9 out of 10, is just silly things like them using that tanker to fight Leatherback and then only using the sword on the next kaiju fight against Itachi. There's a bunch of little silly things like that in this movie. But yeah, what about you, Miles?
I am going to knock it down a point. I am going to give it an 8 out of 10. I do think that while the script is as good as it can be in certain aspects for the runtime it has with what it's trying to do, I do think either it needed to be longer or they should have said, okay, we'll set this up in the next movie and just tightened it up a little bit. In this case, I do agree about the muted tones in terms of color. I would have liked that also reflected in the Jaeger designs. Similarly with the kaiju designs, I would have liked a little more flavor there. We've talked about that. Acting, phenomenal. Directing, phenomenal. Music, it's fine. But I mean, everything is great, but it should have been like superb. And I think that like, and it's one, it's an expectation that we are giving on to it because we don't, especially in 2013, we didn't get movies like this very often, which is why like it was such a watershed moment for a lot of us, because like we just got a big budget giant robot versus monster movie. We don't get those. Like this is like 1 year out from Avengers, you know, like it's we're just in the dawn of the superhero movie in terms of the MCU and stuff. So like we're not where we are now. So yeah, like, well, this movie, I think it deserves a lot of passes in that respect.
It does. It is amazing to us now that they would have made this movie, because it's not a superhero movie, you know.
Right.
But yeah, back then they were still, like I said, they were given $150 million to like Clash of the Titans,
right?
Wrath of the Titans, to make those crazy CGI films. So
love Wrath of the Titans.
it is awesome that this movie just came to fruition at all.
And yeah, absolutely.
Del and like Toro at the helm.
And this is me being, this is where I'm the most nitpicky, but even then it's an 8 out of 10. Like this is a very, very good movie. And the technical aspect, like, the production value is phenomenal. The stuff that I'm nitpicking is like, this is what keeps this from being a perfect movie for me.
Yeah.
But what might pop it back up, I think, for both of us is its evocative nature.
Its importance as a kaiju movie, I don't think could be understated. You know, along with, you know, in 2014, the rebirth of Godzilla in the legendary universe. And like I said, Cloverfield giving us the boom that we're enjoying right now. We're still reaping the benefits of this film a decade later. And, you know, yes, this movie has gotten some sequels in various aspects. And we talked about the mockbuster Atlantic Rim last week. But this, I feel like this did inspire so many things, even though we don't get any other real giant monsters versus robot films. I think this signaled to Hollywood. And after this movie came out, you had Hollywood knocking on Japan's door and was like, oh, maybe we can do a Gundam movie, which has been in production for, you know, decades. Ever. But, you know, is maybe going to a live action Gundam film happen in the next few years?
Yeah, they keep changing up the production of that one. So I'm not gonna lie, my hope is dwindling a little bit.
But yeah, this I think helped prime the world for the legendary Godzilla. But even more so, I feel like Godzilla King of the Monsters, the 2019 film, has a lot to thank this film for, because that's just a big monster mash, you know.
No, I mean, the monster mashes are not uncommon in the Godzilla franchise, let's be honest.
Finally another one that has just so many kaiju coming out your ears. This movie, Guillermo del Toro, I feel like not only made kind of a passion project for his interests, but was able to synthesize just tons of things that he loved from tokusatsu and anime, Japanese culture, and also added his own flair to it and an international kind of feeling that we don't really get in any other kaiju movie.
Yeah, and honestly, it's something I wish they'd harped on a little bit more.
Yeah,
the international, like, unified body that was this Jaeger program. I kind of wanted a little bit more from that, because I agree that it's a wonderful idea.
Yeah, and it's something that can be done from this director specifically. So all that being said, for its importance as a kaiju film, its evocative nature, I do feel like this is pretty perfect. I'm giving it a 10 out of 10 for its importance. And boy howdy, I'm excited to watch the sequel with you, Miles. What about you?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I don't know if I give it all the credit for kickstarting. It certainly signals the flair that this is something that people are, you know, with a decade out of like full broadband and access to other stuff and information and getting movies that we hadn't got before in terms of monster movies, Japanese films across the board. This, I think, does signal like, hey, in terms of your AAA budget films, we are certainly ready for something like this. And this movie proves that. Even if its box office draw wasn't quite as gangbusters as we get today, I think it was still the fact that it made the money it did absolutely proved there is an interest in this. And for anything that it may not like do 100%, everything that it does do, I mean, in terms of an American production, we hadn't done this right before. Like, no. Outside of Cloverfield, this is the best we do for a few years. But like,
well, like I said, before this, the widest released kind of like Hollywood kaiju movie was 1998's Godzilla.
Right.
So, this is righting so many wrongs, you know.
Right. Exactly. And so for that, I mean, I think this is an excellent addition to the annals of kaiju cinema, because we get the giant robot versus the giant monster in a way that we hadn't in terms of a big budget film. And I think this does set the stage for things. Even if I'm not going to give it all of the credit for the kaiju boom, it is certainly the canary in the coal mine. And no, yeah, I am also giving it a 10 out of 10.
It's definitely one of the pillars that is the reason why, you know, we got two Godzilla movies just last year, and a ton of other great projects coming down the line, and things being brought over from Japan. I think SRS Cinema has been able to keep pumping out films on DVD because there's a renewed interest in kaiju. And like I said, we started this podcast a few years ago when the boom was in full swing, and we're just reaping the benefits because we get to keep watching movies. So that's going to give me a softer 10 out of 10 for Pacific Rim. You're at a 9 out of 10, and our podcast final is a 9 out of 10. 10. Not a perfect score for Pacific Rim, but like I said, we both enjoyed this so much. I can stop recording right now. Yeah. And I can watch this.
A 9 is certainly not a bad score.
No. This is I think the best of this season thus far. We gave an 8 to Jellyfish Eyes, which we both.
Yeah, we screwed the pooch there. Well, you did at least.
You gave it a 9. But and then so far the highest, is that going to stand? We've got like 30 more films, I feel like, in this season, the 2010. So we have a lot of ways to go, but. Oh, where can folks find us if they want to chat Pacific Rim?
All right. Well, you can email us at kaijuversushistory@gmail.com. You can tweet to us at kaijuversushistory. You can visit our website, kaijuversushistory.com. Please rate and review our show, comment, share with your friends, and let us know what you think. Check out our Letterboxd account to see all our reviews and our list of films, Kaiju versus History. You can also join the Cosmic Crit Discord. We have a Kaiju versus History channel where Patrick and I are sharing stuff and chatting Kaiju films all the time. I'm mostly sharing toy stuff and new goofy stuff that is coming out in between the big stuff. And please come talk to us. Patrick, what are we doing next week?
This came out a month from now, but we are recording this on Godzilla Day, November 3rd, which is very fun, but we wish everyone a happy Godzilla Day in the Discord there. Yeah, thank you, Miles. We're going to be back next week. We've already mentioned what we're doing next week, but it is another American kaiju film that was released in theaters, and we're going to find out what happens when a multiplying, magnifying spider threat gets to be a take on some bad CGI and take on downtown L.A., join us for flammable webbing and spider stabbing on next week's episode. That's right. Next time, tune in with us for History versus Big Ass Spider. Bah, 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 bah.